Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Prescription Drugs Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On March 29, 2011, the Supreme Court announced its decision in Astra USA versus Santa Clara County. The question in this case was whether healthcare providers, due to their status as a third-party beneficiary, could sue drug manufacturers for not following price limitations set by contracts between the manufacturers and the federal government. In an opinion delivered by Justice Ginsburg, the court held by an 8-0 vote that healthcare providers may not bring suits against drug manufacturers to enforce ceiling price contracts between the manufacturers and the federal government. Justice Kagan took no part in the consideration or decision of the case. To discuss the case, we have Jeffrey S. Buchholz, who is a partner in the Appellate Practice Group at King & Spalding. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Buchholz.
Hi, this is Jeff Buchholz at King & Spalding to talk about the Supreme Court's decision from March 29 in the case of Astra USA, Inc. against Santa Clara County. This is a case about whether 340B entities, including Santa Clara County, could sue as third-party beneficiaries under federal common law to bring a contract claim against drug manufacturers to recover alleged overcharges under contracts between the drug manufacturers and HHS. The Supreme Court held no. To provide a little bit more background about the parties and the issue, the plaintiffs in the case, the respondents in the Supreme Court, were Santa Clara County and some other counties that operate what are called 340B entities. These are essentially, to oversimplify a little bit, safety net healthcare providers that under the Federal Public Health Services Act are entitled to discounts from drug manufacturers if the drug manufacturers choose to participate in the federal Medicaid program. All major drug manufacturers choose to participate in Medicaid because it's such a huge market. And as a condition of participation in Medicaid, the drug manufacturers agree to provide these 340B entities discounts on drugs. The statutory discount formula is complicated, and I won't try to get into the details of it in this podcast. But suffice it to say, because this is important to the case, that the discounts relate both to the Medicaid drug rebate program, where states get rebates from drug manufacturers for their Medicaid drug costs, and to the 340B program. And this is the important point, the relationship goes in opposite directions. So one of the statutory discount prices, if the price is calculated in a way that makes that price point higher, that benefits the states while harming 340B entities, or vice versa, so that the Medicaid program and the 340B program actually operate in some tension with each other. And the other important thing to note about the program is that although the statute refers to these discount prices, the statute does not define how to calculate these prices with any degree of specificity or, I guess I would say, clarity, and neither has HHS in administrative forums over the years provided a lot of clarity. And so there's, in practice, been a lot of scope for manufacturers to, like it or not, have to make decisions about the right way to calculate these discount prices. And that has led to the allegations made by the plaintiffs in this case, arising out of an investigative report by the Government Accountability Office that said that there were rampant overcharges going on in this program nationwide. So that led a couple of enterprising counties led by Santa Clara to bring this lawsuit, saying that the counties could be third-party beneficiaries of the contracts between HHS and the drug manufacturers. Speaking of the contracts, the way this program works, it's created by statute, but it's put into practice through contracts. They're reform contracts, and as the court emphasized in the case, the contracts are not negotiated contracts. They're not meaningfully contracts in any different way from the statute itself. So the statute imposes the discount pricing obligations. The manufacturer opts into the program, to Medicaid and the 340B program, by signing the form contract called a pharmaceutical pricing agreement with HHS. And the terms that the 340B entities were trying to enforce as contractual beneficiaries really come from the statute itself and not in any meaningful sense from the contract. I think that was undisputed in the case. So the claims that the plaintiffs brought were third-party beneficiary claims under federal common law, under the federal common law of contracts. The plaintiffs conceded that the statute itself, the 340B statute itself, did not create a private right of action. And they said, nonetheless, they should be able to have a private right of action under the federal common law of contracts as third-party beneficiaries. The Ninth Circuit said that they could. The Ninth Circuit granted them that implied federal common law right of action, essentially on the rationale that HHS could use the help of third-party private attorneys general, if you will, in enforcing the 340B obligations to ensure compliance with the obligations of the program. It's interesting to note that the Ninth Circuit said that HHS could benefit from the help of these third-party lawsuits without noticing in its decision that HHS had actually filed an amicus brief and said that it would wreak havoc with the uniform administration of the Medicaid and 340B programs if third-party beneficiaries, alleged third-party beneficiaries like 340B entities, were allowed to bring these lawsuits. The Ninth Circuit just didn't acknowledge that amicus brief position by the U.S. government. And that was to come back to haunt the Ninth Circuit when the case got to the Supreme Court. Essentially, the arguments in the Supreme Court made by Astra and the other drug manufacturers that were the petitioners were threefold. First, they argued that the absence of a statutory right of action for damages is the end of the matter, that if Congress didn't create a private right of action in the statute, the courts don't have the authority to essentially circumvent that decision by Congress by creating a private right of action and putting a different label on it, that is the label of third-party beneficiary contract claim, where it would essentially be the same as the cause of action that Congress didn't create. The second argument they made is that even if there could be some circumstances where, despite the absence of a statutory cause of action, a court could create a third-party beneficiary contract cause of action to essentially the same ends, these were not appropriate circumstances for a court to do that, because here Congress intended HHS to exercise its expert authority over the Medicaid and 340B programs to reconcile the potentially conflicting interests of participants in the programs, to make the difficult expert judgment calls about pricing methodologies, and to, in general, operate the programs in a way that was efficient and in accordance with congressional intent, and that it would be in conflict with that harmonious, uniform expert administration for there to be third-party beneficiary lawsuits around the country. The third argument the petitioners made is that even if you get past all of that, the 340B entities are not really third-party beneficiaries under the common law of contracts, because you have to be an intended beneficiary in order to qualify under the common law, and neither party to the contracts here intended that the 340B entities be able to bring lawsuits like this. And again, if you look back to the amicus brief that the government filed in the Ninth Circuit, the amicus brief used very strong language in saying that HHS could not have imagined that the 340B entities could bring damages lawsuits like this, and of course, neither could have the drug manufacturers. The other side, the 340B entities, argued in the Supreme Court essentially that the absence of a private right of action under the statute was the starting point, not the ending point of the analysis, and that there is a well-established body of federal common law of contracts that includes well-established third-party beneficiary principles, and there's no reason to think that Congress displaced that whole body of law when it simply silently did not create a private right of action. It didn't say in the statute, and we also don't want there to be third-party beneficiary claims under common law. And the inference that the plaintiffs or respondents tried to get the court to draw from that was that Congress intended just to have the courts look to the ordinary background principles of contract law. And the 340B entities emphasized, from a policy perspective, the perceived need to have lawsuits like this to supplement HHS's efforts to administer the program. According to the 340B entities, HHS has not done much to enforce the 340B pricing requirements, has taken a hands-off approach, and has allowed the drug manufacturers to get away with rampant overcharging over the years. The Supreme Court decided the case on March 29, and there are a few notable things about the Supreme Court's decision that I'll come to in a second. But first, just to summarize it, the court held, in agreement with the arguments made by the drug manufacturers, that the lawsuits brought by the 340B entities were not compatible with the statute creating the 340B program and had not been authorized by Congress and could not be brought. The decision was 8-0, Justice Kagan did not participate in the case because when she was Solicitor General, the government filed its amicus brief in the lower court. So she didn't participate. So the case was unanimous except for her lack of participation. A few notable things about the opinion. The Supreme Court has a way of making what at one point in the process of the life of a case might have seemed like a difficult, complicated case seem easy when the court decides it the way that it wants to decide it. And when a decision is unanimous, sometimes some of the more difficult issues that have accumulated along the life of a case along the way drop out, and the case, when you read the opinion, looks easy, and you wonder how anyone ever could have argued the contrary. And I think that's the way many people will react to this opinion. The opinion came out barely 2 months after oral argument, and it is only 10 pages long. It really makes this case seem quite simple. One other notable thing about the opinion is that I described the three different arguments made by the petitioners a moment ago. The court did not address the third one. It didn't have to get to the question of whether these 340B entities really were intended third-party beneficiaries under the common law of contracts. But on the first two issues, the petitioners and the amicus briefs, and I should say at this point that I had the privilege of working on an amicus brief in this case for Pharma at both the petition stage and the merit stage in support of the drug manufacturers, the petitioners, making similar arguments to the ones made by the manufacturers. The petitioners and the amici in support of them broke down the arguments in the two different ways that I mentioned. One, the lack of power of federal courts to create a cause of action that Congress didn't create, and two, the wisdom under the circumstances here of a federal court doing so, assuming that it had the power. And those really, if you think about them, are two quite different issues. The Supreme Court lumped those two issues together to an extent, and that's not surprising when you look at the unanimous opinion. There have been a lot of hard-fought battles on the Supreme Court over the last generations about the nature of rights of action under federal law and the role of federal courts in creating remedies that Congress itself has not explicitly created. There might have been some votes on the Supreme Court for the proposition that if the statute didn't create a cause of action, that was the end of the matter, but I very much doubt there were 8 votes for that position. And so the opinion is unanimous in holding that that number one, it would circumvent Congress's failure to create a private right of action under the statute to allow essentially the same right of action and just calling it a common law contract right of action here. But also, the court relies heavily on the holding that it would interfere with HHS's ability to administer this program in a uniform and sensible way to have private lawsuits like the lawsuits that the respondents here tried to bring. The court doesn't distinguish clearly between those two elements of its holding. It puts the two of those things together and gets 8 votes without any dissent for the proposition that these lawsuits are not proper. Two other things to note quickly about the decision before wrapping up. One is that the health care reform statute last year amended the 340B program and created or provided for HHS to create new administrative dispute resolution mechanisms. And there was a little bit of a fight in this case about the relevance of the 2010 statutory amendments. Those amendments do not apply to the claims in this case because they're not retroactive. But the inference to draw from those amendments was the subject of some dispute. What the court says about those amendments is if anything, it shows that when Congress recognized that there might be a need for additional dispute resolution mechanisms here, it looked not to private litigation in the courts, but rather to more robust resolution proceedings before HHS itself. The second thing to note about the decision is that as with the Ninth Circuit proceedings, the Obama administration strongly supported the drug manufacturers in the Supreme Court on the proposition that it would interfere with HHS's ability to run these programs for private lawsuits to be going on around the country, asserting competing pricing methodologies. The court relies pretty heavily on the administration's view that it would interfere with the proper operation of these programs. The court does so without saying in so many words that it's deferring to the government's view in any Chevron sense or any recognized sense, but it is clear from the opinion the court cared a lot about the government's position on that. And I think it's interesting to note the relationship between the court's reliance on the government's position on this issue in this case and what's happened recently in implied preemption cases in the Supreme Court. In Williamson recently, the court held unanimously that there was no preemption through a NHTSA safety standard of claims under state law, and the court relied heavily in doing so on the government's view that those state law claims would not interfere with the proper administration of the regulatory scheme. And it's been said by many over the years correctly that it's extremely difficult to win, maybe even impossible, in the Supreme Court on an implied preemption argument if the government is not on your side. It may be easier to win on the slightly different flavor of argument made by the drug manufacturers here than on a true implied preemption argument, even if the government were against you. But it certainly helps to have the government on your side explaining that it doesn't want any help, in quotes, from private lawsuits by the likes of the respondents here.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.